brought to you by CGTN Europe.
I'm Stephen Cole. Welcome to The Agenda. The United Nations stated goal is that everyone on Earth should have access to clean water and sustainable sanitation by 2030. And yet, just a decade away, billions of people still don't. So on this episode, we're looking at water security. I began by talking to Dr. Piers Clark, founder and chairman of Arles Utilities, about the true scale of the current water crisis.
I mean, what people often forget is that we think about water crises just in the terms of running out of water, but it has so many other impacts around, it's not just about droughts, it's about flooding, it's about emerging pollutants, it's about habitat degradation. There's so many sort of other aspects to the water crisis than just running out of water.
So what are the people in charge of our water doing to alleviate those problems about water stress, water security?
So all around the world, this is a common issue. There isn't a single utility who doesn't think about how they can manage their water resources better. And there's lots of things where people are looking at doing water meters and managing their water consumption better. Ultimately, it comes down to the public being engaged in the problem. People forget, for example, that for every piece of toast you produce, you eat, 500 litres of water, and in US gallons, that's about 130 US gallons of water goes into generating a single piece of toast, and 25,000 litres for a microchip. And so actually what we've really got to do to manage the water resources is make sure that the public are aware of how much water is used in their everyday products.
I know when I lived in the Middle East, I found in one country in particular, petrol was cheaper than water, which is quite remarkable. And it was bottled water as well. But I wonder, I mean, that's because of desalination, I suspect, but which is expensive. Is technology keeping up with water stress?
So there's some amazing opportunities in water. You refer to desalination as being expensive, and you're absolutely right. You're squeezing water out of, squeezing clean water out of salty water is an incredibly energy intensive thing to do. And typically people imagine water comes from, you either take it from a lake or a reservoir, or you dig a hole in the ground and you take the water out of a well, or you use desalination. There is a fourth way which is now gaining real traction, and that is called atmospheric water generation. It's actually where you suck the water straight out of the air. And there are a number of companies, Sky H2O and Rainmaker, which have now developed credible solutions for doing that. And they're much more environmental, they use less energy, and they particularly don't create this nasty brine that you create when you do desalination. So they've got all sorts of extra benefits.
In Britain, this is a European show, but in Britain, I know soon as there are weeks and weeks and weeks of rain, within a couple of months, it'll be May or June, and there'll be
housepipe
bans. So that's about water management, isn't it? So, and you manage the utility. Did you find you had to take a lot of steps to improve water management?
Yeah, so the bit that gets more complicated with climate change is we're getting shorter, sharper bursts of rain. So the rain will fall out of the skies, hits the tarmac and the roads, and then it goes straight into the sewer system and flushes out into the seas within probably 24 hours. And if we haven't got reservoirs where you can capture that water and store it, once it's sort of made it into the rivers, you've lost it, which is why there's lots of talk about building new reservoirs and new storage patterns. Because what we used to have was rain that would trickle down in a more gentle way and would then go into the ground and refill our aquifers. Now that we've got climate change with these much more intense bursts of rain, they sweep through the system like a bolt, and we don't get to capture the water in the way that we would have done in the past.
Okay, so that calls for collaboration, perhaps in Britain, perhaps in Europe. But what about global collaboration? Is there enough global collaboration to help countries with very arid climates?
So there can always be better collaboration. There are a variety of schemes. The World Water Innovation Fund, for example, involves a dozen or so utilities from Latin America to Australia to Europe to North America, working together to share their learnings and their experiences. There's always more that can be done, clearly. And actually, the real help that needs to come is from utilities in high-income countries sharing their learning and experiences with utilities in the low and medium-income countries. Because that's where there's often this skill set that doesn't exist. Leakage is a great example of where learning could be better.
Another major concern is that much of the world's clean water, between 50 and 70%, according to a recent report, is stolen. The author of that report, Dr. Adam Locke from the Centre for Global Food and Resources, University of Adelaide, explained to me just what he meant by stolen water.
Literally just that. So it's really not terribly much different. You can either be taking groundwater, for example, through a pump, which doesn't belong to you. So that groundwater has been provided as a right to somebody to use on their farm or in their industry or whatever it might be, or even to water their cattle, etc. And you sink an illegal well, or even a legal well, and you take water when it's not your turn or where you don't have the right to do so, you're stealing that water. You could be, again, turning on a pump in a river system. You could be opening a gate on a canal, whatever it might be, when you're not supposed to and it's not your water, and you're stealing that water. So it's the same as taking a car or a cow or anything else, really.
And who does stealing water hurt?
Well, predominantly the people to whom the water belongs in the first instance. And so they're not getting their supply as they expected. So that will impact on their production. It'll impact on their livestock. It may impact on their drinking supply. It also has a bigger impact on the people who manage water on our behalf. So if that water is coming out of a large storage or even out of a river, which has been managed in the national good, then equally they're being impacted by this. And then that essentially has a flow-on impact. As I say, if it's 70 or 80% of the water being used by agriculture, that's going to put pressure on other users if additional water has got to be found elsewhere in the system to make up those losses. So really, it can impact all of us.
And whereabouts in the world is most of the theft taking place? I would think, any normal person would think, it's in the largely arid areas where access to water is so valuable.
Yeah, well, that would be a good assumption. And the simple answer to your question is, I really have no idea. We have such limited data on this issue. Thieves obviously aren't going around telling us what they're doing. We tend in some contexts to overlook it. And indeed, as we showed in our paper, the United States is just one context, which in some areas in California simply turns a blind eye to the issue and doesn't deal with it. So in our case, we looked at developed countries, Spain, Australia and the US. I agree with you. I would have initially said that it was the developing nations with less advanced institutions where the problem would be greatest, and indeed that might be the case. But frankly, I think we all may know a water thief. I know I do. I used to be an irrigator, and we were aware of several people in our area that were stealing water, and as far as I know, one of them still is.
And where is that?
I'm not saying. It was in central Queensland, yeah.
So central Queensland, again, a very arid area. So people are going to find, it's an extremely valuable commodity.
It is. And I think that was what really motivated us to be very concerned as well, coming into the paper. As you say, arid areas are more likely to experience this phenomenon. But the whole world is becoming more arid. Water globally is becoming scarce and increasingly so. And so we've got to get on top of this problem if we want to ensure that it doesn't become a major issue for us going forward.
You talked initially about agricultural water being stolen. Is the theft of clean drinking water a problem as well?
Yes, it is. And I think the thing that was most interesting to me was the Californian case study. Where water, clean drinking water from either fire hydrants, because that is in a sense potable, or from hose pipes, you know, domestic hose pipes, was being stolen at an enormous amount to water marijuana crops, which are now legal in that state. And of course, the returns are very high. Getting a permit for those crops is apparently too much trouble. And so, of course, it's just easier to go and steal the water from somebody else, in a sense of faceless, victimless crime if you're using a fire hydrant, to grow your crop, and everybody thinks that they're better off. But of course, everybody in the state has their water rights diminished. So yes, for an agricultural point of view around marijuana crops in California, yes, it's stealing domestic water in that sense. As I said before, in places like India and elsewhere where water is particularly scarce, populations are very high, yes, the theft of drinking water has, I think, long been a problem.
A lack of knowledge and education about how to deal with water security is one of the key issues behind a looming water crisis. Many organisations around the world, though, are trying to correct that, including the Global Water Partnership. Its Senior Programme Officer for the Mediterranean, Konstantin Atoli, joins me now from Athens. Would you say there's a high level of cooperation around the world to try and stave off a possible water crisis?
Indeed, there is cooperation at global level and also at local and regional level. GWP is very much promoting multi-stakeholder partnerships. We understand that we cannot solve the problem alone. Actually, no one can solve water issues alone. So this is why we need all these partnerships. We partner with different stakeholders, with organizations, but also with the private sector, with civil society organizations, in order to promote these good practices that would eventually take us to water security.
Is the real problem, Konstantina, that people take water for granted?
Not everywhere in the world, Stephen. Apparently, in developed countries, yes, we do take water for granted, and also the pandemic was an occasion of that. We had access to safe water so that we could wash our hands like 1,000 times a day. But these 2.1 billion of people who lack access to safe water don't take it for granted. Eventually, our work, also through the Sustainable Development Goals, is to achieve this water security, to allow access and to enable access, to enable access to safe water. So for these people, the ones that have to walk for kilometers, and for women that have to walk for kilometers to bring some water back home, for the people that don't have clean water, a source of clean water or access to treated water, water is not for granted.
Is enough being done to educate people about water?
Apparently not. I've been in the water sector for 12 years now, and while we have seen all these good efforts from many organizations, including the Global Water Partnership, apparently I believe that we have not done enough. Usually when we have a water crisis, either because of drought or because of climate change, we do have a campaign on water. But you will realize, and also looking at what has been happening all these past months, that we don't have enough campaigns, for example, on the use of water during the pandemic, of not letting your tap run while you're washing off your hands. I believe that we are not doing enough. There is a lot to be done, and eventually you can only change people's mindsets and people's behaviors only through education. So if you don't integrate education into the school curriculum, and you bring up these children with these principles of being not only cautious with water, but eventually to value water for its for all that it offers. It means not only sustaining our life, but it's also sustaining ecosystems, it's sustaining economic activities. So eventually, we need to do more at schools, but also educate the parents, I would say.
And I suppose educate parents and children about the fact that water doesn't exist alone. It is connected, as you say, to climate and to energy, food and all these other sectors. So it's an essential part of this formula.
Indeed, we cannot. Most of the economic activities are related to water, either directly or indirectly. Even in processes and productions that are not related to water per se, we need, for example, cooling, and cooling usually comes from water. You use water to cool down your process. Energy is the same thing. Apart from the obvious relation of hydropower, we do have all other energy-producing activities would also require water, but it's also the other way around. In order to produce water or even to pump it up, even if you have water and you need to pump it up and you have to distribute it through your water supply networks, you need energy. So these are very, very closely interlinked, and they're also interlinked with other sectors, with food, for example. How can you produce food if you don't have water? We, in the water sector, in among water organizations, we're working industriously towards linking all these sectors and understanding their interlinkages.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of The Agenda. Join me again next week when I'll be looking back at a lost decade for biodiversity. Remember, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can also find us on CGTN Europe, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
The most interesting questions.
Are there other living beings beyond Earth?
Will man or machine be in charge?
Great question.
Always have more than one answer.
Well, hold on, let me just draw up a list.
And always come from more than one person.
That's where the credibility lies.
The concept of having a machinery which is alive and evolving didn't wait for us.
The end of inequality of incomes and wealth around the world, can you imagine how difficult that is at the moment to achieve?
Every episode, Stephen Cole, Murray Beveridge, and some of the brightest minds out there shed light on the answers to some of the most intriguing questions.
There are two ways of looking at this.
Machines can't really discriminate between civilian and military targets.
The Answers Project.
Maybe we need to just look at this in a bit more detail.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
The Answers Project, a new podcast from CGTN Europe.